When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and I'm thrilled to be joined today by Christopher Sellers. He is professor of history at Stony Brook University and the author of several major works of environmental history, including Crabgrass Crucible, Dangerous Trade, and Hazards of the Job. He joins me today to discuss his brand new book. It's called Race and the Greening of Atlanta: Inequality, Democracy, and Environmental Politics in an Ascendant Metropolis. It came out just a couple of weeks ago from the University of Georgia Press. Dr. Sellers, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. Pleased to be here and get to talk about this book that has been so long in gestation and finally is out into the world.
Well, the results are just phenomenal. I mean, it's just such a major work. It makes a big contribution. You know, we have some books that shine a light on the environmental dimensions of the Black freedom struggle. We have now quite a few works that probe kind of the whiteness of post-war environmentalism in the United States. But here you look at these moments, these movements, just side by side and in one city and set in the full context of politics and economic transformations of the second half of the 20th century. And it's just really totally revelatory. And everyone should just pause the program right now, go order the copy or get your library to order the copy, then turn us back on. And because we're only going to be able to scratch the surface of just the book's riches in the time that we have today or today here. But just to start off, I wonder, you know, could you tell us why you decided to write this book at this time and how you see it fitting into the long arc of your career?
Well, it has been a long process of gestation. And, you know, I think I started the first interviews in this book back in the early 2000s. It was part of the Crabgrass Crucible project. It was my sort of southern city case study looking at Atlanta. So, you know, that project itself took a while. And so 2012, I guess that book came out. But the process of getting that project into sort of its first book iteration with New York and Los Angeles, I came to realize how different the Atlanta case was. I found myself constantly in trying to write these three case studies together, having to talk about the exceptional history of Atlanta, just a different region with a different past, a different trajectory. And there were so many differences, too, that I had to basically drop it out of Crabgrass Crucible because it was getting in the way of making the main points that I think emerged in writing about Los Angeles and New York. But I couldn't give it up. I mean, this is my region, actually, and I've never written anything about Southern history, but I grew up there in the South. And so this is kind of my way of sort of engaging that my own past, that of my family and, you know, places where I grew up, really trying to get a grip on what my parents went through. And so this is, it also, it moved me also to to more of a whole city approach, because I don't think you can really understand the differences between Atlanta and cities in other regions without looking at the whole and looking at the long history as well. And really digging into those differences, looking at the poorer parts of the city as well as the richer parts, and then stepping back and you know, I know you're so I think it's really moved my thinking along, and really been a joy to try and figure out and come up with, using my historian's chops, to really try and understand where we are today in the South, but also it's a national, it's a story with national implications, as we see today with all the to-do that is happening in Atlanta. I mean, politics is really, Atlanta is one of the, is a national center stage. And so I think my book helps to explain in a lot of ways why.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to the exceptional nature of Atlanta in a minute. But first, just thinking about how you went about writing this book and how you approached the topic and the tools you used. Certainly, there's historian's chops here on display, but you talk about employing a methodological hybrid. And you're using the insights of several fields of history, but also you're looking at other fields, other, you know, disciplines beyond history. Could you say a bit about some of the shortcomings in the literature about cities in this time, and that any one of those fields is not well equipped to address, and then how you tried to blend methods together to address them?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a lot of my struggle to pull this book together, is to try and figure out what the method should be. And I think, you know, my training is in environmental history, and so that's kind of a starting point for me. Only for me, it was really difficult to get, especially at the political side, the political institutions and their history, through the lens of environmental history. I think environmental history is kind of veered away from political analysis and dynamics and so on. As it's, I mean, it's opened up lots of new pathways in doing so. Very interesting where things have gone, but it's also made us less capable, I think, of really addressing environmental politics. And so this is a part of my effort. So I've reached out to political history for one thing, and really and folded that in more robustly into my account, and developed some ways like citizenship analysis and so on to connect environmentalism, environmental movements with the larger political landscape. And I think that's a lot of the environmental history that does deal with politics is just dealing with the environmental movement. And it really is so centered on that one vein of politics. But I think to understand where we are today, especially a moment where a major party is now shorn itself of many of the principles of environmental citizenship. That's a moment that I think environmental history really needs to grapple with. Now, other I may be going on a little long here, but I think also I was watching the new political history emerge over the last decade and more, as historians move from social history back into political history. And I think that literature has had trouble dealing with the environment. I mean, you look at the syntheses that the new political historians have come up with about the 20th century, and they really have trouble sort of, where does environment fit in? Even though we know it's, you know, I think I have a personal interest in this, so I'm a little bit biased, but I think it really has become ever more critical to our nation's future and politics and political economy. To take environment seriously. And those battles have become ever more pointed as well in the nation's political culture. And so we need a way of fitting that into our politics. So one of my innovations is to try and find and come up with a way in this Atlanta book of doing that, of showing how critical environmental politics became after environmentalism became a recognized cause and movement and with its own organizations and sort of political projects and so on for the state. So connecting that to the growth of the state, and also talking about how the erasure of the environmental sides to the state was a part of this new conservative movement just reducing the state to being about welfare and so on. And then the final leg of this was economic. I've been watching as this new economic literature has emerged, a lot of it by economists on economic inequality and income gaps and works like Thomas Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century. And I think labor historians, economic historians, urban historians have indeed addressed economic inequality, and they continue to do so and realize the importance of those kinds of divides, but without really integrating the insights from these economists in terms of waxing and waning income gaps and wealth gaps and that sort of thing, it's become such a part of our political culture too. I mean, but historians have been a little slow, I think, to absorb that. And having done a class for, you know, 2 decades now on wealth and inequality in the modern corporate age, I've had to acquaint myself with that literature, and I think figured out a way in this Atlanta book of folding that kind of insight and that kind of angle on history into the mix and making it an integral part of trying to explain why Atlanta has these waxing and waning commitments to democracy.
It's really thrilling the way it comes together. And so, in the subtitle, we have inequality, democracy, and environmental politics. And it really has an equal amount to say about each of those things. And for that reason, it not only helps environmental historians kind of draw from those other fields, but I think it really speaks to those other fields as well and brings a question of what the environmental movement is doing for those other things and how they are implicated in them. And so I think we'll see this in the conversation, but it's really, it delivers on the promise of the title in that way.
That's good to hear.
So starting here, I'll stop fanboying and we'll get on here. So thinking about the origin, the chapter one here, you begin with sort of a prehistory of Atlanta before World War II. What do people need to know about the city to understand the rise of post-war civil rights and environmental movements there?
Well, I think they need to get people need to get beyond the Chamber of Commerce hype about Atlanta. The claims about Atlanta being such an icon of the New South. I think if you look at the numbers, really in the economic side of things, Atlanta was a pretty modest-sized city. Other cities had bigger textile industries and mills and so on. And it was also a city that was tied. I mean, the critical thing for me in contrasting in a place like Los Angeles or New York is that it was tethered to this impoverished hinterland that really became a drag, I think, on economically speaking, on its growth, on its population growth, on its size. Atlanta was quite small, less than below the it was not in the top 25 cities until after World War II, and that because of various annexations and so on. So puncturing that Chamber of Commerce narrative and looking at the poverty, the inequality, you also see, I went into the tax records and looked at the distribution, and that economic inequality, it was really growing over the early 20th century as the Jim Crow regime really got going and dominated the politics of the region. So I think that economic inequality, the growing share of wealth that was held just by a tiny white economic elite, is a big part of the story. Also, how they didn't have as large a middle class as other cities, even in the South, not to mention the North, where industry was a bigger contributor to the economic pie and so on. So I think those things, as well as the upshot of that, is also really remarkable political inequality. Jim Crow was not just about suppressing blacks. It was about just keeping a white elite in charge. And those electorates from the Jim Crow policies like literacy tests and all white primaries, that turnout was only 18% in Atlanta all the way up through the 1950s. Really remarkable how constrained democracy was in this time period, which is why political scientists now talk about it as authoritarian. is electoral democracy, but it was a racially authoritarian regime. And that was true of the state at the state level, where you had rustic rule and the Talmudges and so on. It was also true at the city level and was reflected in, for instance, the 1950s decision-making about urban renewal. I mean, who called those shots? A very tiny clique of people in Atlanta and then the state highway department. Really, you know, they determined where those routes meant and whose neighborhoods were going to be decimated. So
I was struck by the way you described Atlanta as, in your words, an American face of unsettling global trends. In what ways did Atlanta have more in common with other cities around the world than with other American cities?
Yes, I think in terms of, you look at the homeowner patterns, homeownership was down in 30%, that kind of thing. Plus, homeownership was closer to the center. There's really a remarkable contrast with those Chicago school maps where, based on, you know, north central city, but they become the iconic sort of understanding of city geography. But Atlanta did not have the poverty in the center, at the core. It had some of that, but poverty was also, it also really dominated the edges of Atlanta. And in that sense, it was much more like the megalopolis as is today of the developing world. And even into 1960, you had the edges of Atlanta having many shanty towns and lots of reliance on outhouses and the kinds of things you associate with the urban edge shanty towns in a place like Monterey or Manila, even today. So that pattern was actually the way that cities grew in the 19th century in Europe and North America as well. But changes, at least in the Northeast and in the richer parts of the U.S., really began to make the city look more like the Chicago model, starting in the 20th century, early 20th century, but especially by the middle of the 20th century. And Atlanta was just not there. It looked more like a developing world city as late as 1960.
When you start to chart the rise of post-war civil rights movement in the city, you place a special emphasis on housing and geography. I mean, we have the canonical figures are there too. MLK is there in the story. But what do we learn from emphasizing the attention that the movement paid to housing and geography?
Well, one of the connections that enables this book to make is to the New Deal and to those policies that really created a more equitable playing field, especially in terms of wages. I mean, the New Deal gets a justifiably bad rap because of its redlining and so on. Atlanta, and really this is true across the country as well, the share of Black homeowners actually doubled at the same, moving at the same pace between 1940 and 1960, as did white ownership. Even though it was much less, it was still about half the white rate, both in 1940 and 1960. Black homeownership really expanded, even if in Atlanta, Atlanta is a great example of how it was really constrained by Jim Crow housing policies and so on. Now, so that's, you have an expanding, and part of this is, I think, to have a movement that energizes a whole community, that community needs to have hope and aspiration and the feeling that some things can change. And I think the rising economic opportunities, rising wages because of the minimum wage laws, especially, and as well as some of the housing policies, a black middle class not only expanded, but this hope arose and came to be cultivated. And the groups that were pushing this, like the Urban League, they were well aware of this. And their hope was that, and they actually, the Urban League was actually pretty complicit with many of these segregation policies, but what they did push for was more Black homeownership, higher quality housing for Blacks and so on. And they really connected it to citizenship and to the sense that this would also create a kind of a subversive sentiment within the Black community. And it did, actually. It got further out of hand than the urban leaders realized. But I think there is that connection, I think, that just looking at the economics, I mean, you need to look at the development of a sort of a political project that involves aspirations for change. And it was stoked, of course, in the case of the Black Civil Rights Movement by the Black Church, and of course, many of the leaders were reverends and so on, like Martin Luther King Jr. as well as Sr. So there was a whole cultural piece to it that and a religious piece too. But I think also this sort of expanding opportunity created by the New Deal, really, that's my argument, that it also created wellsprings that there's somewhat recognized in the literature, but making that connection through looking at the housing and the changes in housing and looking at that suburban house that Martin Luther King moved into in 1960. I mean, it really, set back with a lawn and shrubs and flowers in the front and so on. So to symbolize opportunity, but and that's where nature also figures in. I think nature becomes this kind of dreaming place where people can begin to see possibilities and to imagine themselves a different future, not just for themselves and their families and in these individual homes, but for their community. And so I think that's what I'm trying to get at in looking at these neighborhood level transformations and the environments that they put into place and the people moving into.
Another place where you identify the kind of flowering of post-war environmentalism in the city is in the fight against water pollution. And unique in Atlanta compared to other fights elsewhere, it's not really about toxins in the water so much as human waste and bacterial pollution in this way. But what's one of the thrilling moves in your book here is to look at this in the context of the end of rustic rule and the opening up of democracy at long last in Atlanta in the 1960s, following important Supreme Court decisions and other things. How are those things connected, water pollution and democratization?
Yeah, that was pretty cool to discover this and, think through, this new water pollution system, that a new water pollution law that they put in after Sanders becomes the governor in 1963, that's right at the time that you're also moving. Georgia has to move to one man, one vote because of the court decisions. And so the whole political system is being reshuffled, and Sanders is running. He actually makes a big deal of how he's going to tackle water pollution. So that becomes his appeal as the electorate suddenly is expanded, as urban voters suddenly have now considerably more clout in the Georgia legislature in terms of congressional seats and so on and apportionments. That water pollution becomes a critical issue in among politicians who represent this new political transformation, this democratization move. And so I think going back, you have to understand how water pollution was, it was seeping up. It was becoming not just into people's, the rivers that ran through people's backyards and streams and so on, because there was this big transition away from the outhouses that in Georgia was really happening after World War II. You also have a lot of discontent and the Talmadgists, Herman, Eugene Talmadge, both recognized, were made to become aware of this and at least made noises of addressing it. And in the middle of the 1950s, the Talmadgist successors, actually set up, under the 1948, federal water pollution control amendments, you could set up water pollution control boards with the states. So a lot of the states had already done this, but it was only in the 50s that the Talmadgists began to do this. And of course, they're very anti-statist and are really, I mean, Talmadge Eugene used to talk about the poor government as being his goal. large government, and you know, also it turns out with water pollution, poorly executed government, because what they set up, the system was, and this is where, you know, I'm writing this as I'm watching the Trump administration come in, and what they're envisioning for the EPA, it's like very similar, because it's all cooperative, no penalties. You put business people on the governing committee, and you don't have any expertise involved, except for consultants in the health department who go in and do some measurements and work with the companies to begin to address whatever problem crops up where there's a lot of complaints. So it becomes kind of they bring almost no court cases. They penalize no one, really. And this is all into the early 60s as water pollution, as the industrialization of Georgia, of Atlanta and Georgia, continues to accelerate. And the Talmadge is really happy to push this along, but also really reluctant to clamp down on any of the cases of water pollution that are really getting people up in arms. The League of Women Voters starts to latch onto the issue. Some of the garden clubs do. But nothing's happening at the state level. Actually, they're allowing people to come to these meetings and occasionally to speak out. But then what happens? It gets buried in this sort of in health department sort of visits and deliberations and negotiations with the company, where they always say we're working on it. It turns out to be extremely ineffectual, and they're only spending like $300,000 at all on pollution control in Georgia by the time that Sanders comes along and begins to run on a platform of stricter water pollution control. So what he does, the new law he brings in with his new legislature that's reformed now with a widened electorate under one man, one vote, he creates a much more empowered department. A Water Pollution Control Board. It has a professional at the head rather than an appointee. He can also take punitive action against companies, and he does. And he begins to get a staff. And actually, they go out there and start sampling rivers without having to be called out by citizen protests. So they begin to take oversight and monitoring surveillance of Georgia's rivers. And it's the first studies you have of the Chattahoochee. And the federal government is already starting to do this, actually. Actually, the first studies of the Chattahoochee are being done at this very moment by the Federal Water Pollution Control Body, because it's in charge of interstate rivers, and it's begun to step up its initiatives. But the Georgia Water Pollution Control Board under Rock Howard really gets out ahead of that and becomes quite aggressive in pursuing the industrial as well as the municipal polluters. And so, you know, modern pollution control is born in Georgia at this very moment that Georgia is transitioning rather suddenly into a more democratic governance and regime.
And the movement really takes off. And by the time we get to the first Earth Day in the city, you're seeing it as not just that a widened electorate has allowed the movement to kind of wrest control of government in some ways and make a more responsive government to environmental concerns, but also, in your words, the movement itself is opening new democratizing avenues. In what ways does it do that?
Right. Well, I think the best way to look at that, to think about that, is in terms of parks. And where the state government was with parks, where also the city government was with parks by 1963 or so, versus where these new groups that coalesce, like the Georgia Conservancy, like the Georgia chapter of the Atlanta chapter of the Sierra Club, what they want, the Friends of the River, that is the Chattahoochee River. The parks that were for one thing, there was very little park development under the Talmadgists. Under rustic rule. They were, most of them, from rural counties and were not, you know, they had a lot of countryside around them that they could kind of take for granted. So that was not an issue at all. And plus, they didn't believe in government, really. other than the ones that built highways for their you know, county elites and so on.
And the notable exception of Stone Mountain, right? That's the one thing.
Yeah, Stone Mountain. That was the park. Actually, that was the first big urban park, metropolitan area park, that the state government was willing to pony up for in the late 50s. They took it over. And, you know, that was because it had this big emblem that was what they restarted. They restarted that whole, the carving that Stone Mountain is now so infamous for.
Of the Confederate leaders.
Leaders, mm-hmm. The leaders of the Confederacy, the sort of lost cause. Mm-hmm. So that was the real appeal of the Stone Mountain Park and creation of that. But they didn't create park. And that was it was also a recreation park where people could do more recreational kinds of activities, but not definitely not a nature park. And in fact, people were disturbed. Some of the people, like biologists at Emory and so on, as well as some of the garden groups, were disturbed by how they were beginning to find some endangered species there on Stone Mountain. Ecosystems that inhabited these pools that formed in up on the granite face, some pretty unique ecology there that was subsequently, you know, erased by all the recreational development. That was one of the impetuses, I think, for the new initiatives that emerge once Georgia democratizes in a big way. And these groups see opportunity, the political opportunity structure emerges where actual citizen groups can actually steer the direction of park making, both within the city and beyond the city, on the city's edges and so on. And that's where you have the growth of a Georgia Conservancy. You have people coming together, garden clubs, networks of garden clubs, networks of the Ornithological Society as well, joining together, a call by a congressman, a liberal congressman who is actually, he votes for the Civil Rights Act and is subsequently booted from his congressional seat after one term. He too ran for Congress after the reshuffling of One Man, One Vote. A new congressional seat opened up. And this is James Mackey. He and some of the activists who are pushing for nature parks, ecologically authentic parks, they're responding, I think, also to the need for ecological authentic parks. It's something that's really, it emerges in suburbs where you already have a lot of grass and sort of domesticated horticulture. But people are saying, well, we want real nature. And so real nature is wilder nature and nature that in which the ecology is actually preserved for people to see it and experience it, rather than paved over for ball fields and recreational kinds of activities, or boats and as they had in Stone Mountain, the lake and so on. These groups emerge, really coalesce in the middle to late 60s. Lots of people coming together. Most of them, if you look at where they hail from, they do hail from the more affluent and white suburbs, almost exclusively white, to begin to push for public control over land. And public control that will secure nature parks, ecological authenticity. The other place is the river. The Chattahoochee River becomes a real focal point for a lot of this pushing and organizing. And that's partly because development is really overwhelming parts of the river, especially down around Cobb County and Marietta. All these new malls opening up, people are seeing the development, the sprawl. They're starting to see the sprawl of Atlanta really move into a higher gear. And so that becomes the grounds for, and a lot of this is that development is happening where wealth has already begun to concentrate, North Atlanta. And so a lot of the development, like the Chattahoochee Save the River movement, is concentrated in the wealthier, wider parts that are seeing this acceleration of development. But it's a collective. I mean, yes, it's home ownership is at the root of it, and that's an individual thing. But homeowners, their homes are not isolated islands. All those islands are connected by land and by rivers that run through them. And so that's this whole idea, ecological citizenship or environmental citizenship that emerges is about, well, we need to bring the state in. We need to have some kind of collective say over what happens to these natural lands around us. It shouldn't be just all up to the private marketplace.
Jimmy Carter is one of several really recognizable figures who appear in your book, and we learn new things about. And you situate Carter, I mean, you identify him, as many scholars do, as maybe the first neoliberal president, but also you acknowledge that he's coming out of the Georgia Conservancy, and he has the kind of the marks of this democratized kind of environmentalism in his past before as governor and then as president. And I was struck by what kind of a seeming contradiction in when you claim that he both, as president, you know, he sped the tread toward this top-down environmental governance. And you mentioned expertise earlier, and we've seen expertise in tension with democracy back to the progressive era, and it's always kind of there at the heart of progressive politics. So he was speeding that top-down environmental governance, but he also made what you say are distinct and little-remembered contributions to the rise of the environmental justice movement. So can you help explain this seeming contradiction for listeners?
Yeah, it is a contradiction. But I think if you look at something like a presidential administration, it's going to be rife with contradictions. It's not very good. And I think so Carter himself personally, I think, is really committed to environment and especially the conservation project. He also his administration becomes the administration that really builds out something like the EPA and OSHA. Occupational safety and health. That's a little bit more, less predictable from his Georgia background, because the labor movement was not a big thing in Georgia, you know, work and so on. And Carter had not really had not really bonded with many labor leaders in Georgia. All that, you know, he tried to, but he didn't. The labor didn't have nearly the same presence in his governorship as it did in his presidency. And I think that's partly because he turned things over to experts from the Northeast, from parts of the country like Eula Bingham, who had background in places like Ohio that had a much stronger labor movement. And he saw the wisdom of that. So I think in that sense, he opened up, and of course, labor and labor activism is one piece of the environmental. It becomes one piece of the environmental justice movement as that emerges in the late 70s into the 80s. But I think the other piece, is what the Carter administration how it also saw the need for environmental oversight of cities, not just the edges of cities, not just the sprawling edges, but also urban environments. And so that actually became a theme. I mean, I one of the things that Kostel, who is the head of the EPA, he made this a point of sort of reaching beyond the suburban constituencies to try and marshal people like farmers. He tried to get the environmental opponents on board. But part of this was he also began to reach out to city constituencies, including the Urban League. And so those conferences that EPA helped sponsor in the late 70s, where they bring together people from the Sierra Club and people from the Urban League together in national forums and so on. I was surprised at that. Surprised to see that. But you know, talking with some of the people involved in that, I think, including some of them who are actually from Atlanta, they told me, well, we got in there and we realized that the environmental movement was too wide and too sort of centered in suburbs, and it really needed to have a broader base. And so they actually made some effort prior to the you know, Warren County and the involvement of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that I talk about later. Prior to that, even the way was being paved for groups like the Sierra Club, and including the Atlanta chapter. I mean, some of those people from the Atlanta chapter of the Sierra Club were at those meetings that called by the in Detroit, I think it was called in part by the EPA to begin to look at urban environments, and they brought the message back home to Atlanta, to the Atlanta Sierras, and so that dialogue began.
Yeah, you've shown in your earlier work and others as well that suburban sprawl is this major catalyst for environmentalism in mid-century America. What's interesting, and we see some of that at that time in Atlanta too, but what's so interesting is how fast Atlanta grows and sprawls later, right? We have in the 80s, I think you have it somewhere in the book, the stat that, let's see, Greater Atlanta led the nation in starts for single-family homes for five straight years in the late 80s and early 90s, right? So, and that's a very different time, especially in the economic history of the city and the country. So how does that later date in a time when inequality is rising in the nation and in the city, how did that affect the politics of sprawl and environmentalism?
That's another big question that I really, I have a complex answer. it's such a tough one. But I think one of the things to recognize first is the similarities between the problems that came with sprawl, you know, earlier versus later. So the similarities, I mean, you have concerns about development and the paving over of natural space or open natural spaces. You also have concerns about air pollution. And air pollution, Atlanta's air pollution in this time period is really beginning to look more like that of Los Angeles. Lots of ozone, a real ozone problem starts to crop up. In the 1980s, it really becomes remarkably worse. And so that even the same pollutants, because it's, of course, it's about automobiles, and sprawl itself is automobile centric development. So there's similarities that have to do with the structural nature of sprawl itself in the 20th century. But they're also, it's very important also to recognize the differences, and especially the role, I think, of an environmental inequality in shaping the response. Timing of other things is also critical, I think. But this is a period when sprawl itself is becoming more sort of unequal. So sprawl, on the one hand, our typical idea about sprawl is that, as this is based from the mid-20th century in places like Los Angeles, that it's about middle-class homeownership spreading outward and so on. I think with Atlanta, both North Atlanta is the wealthy white side of Atlanta. That's the biggest sort of beneficiary of sprawl, where sprawl goes the fastest, the furthest and the fastest. But Atlanta, because of the rising economic inequality in Atlanta, the middle class itself is beginning to lose traction in terms of the share of economic growth, and more of the sprawl, the new developments are being oriented toward luxury markets and so on. And that group brings up another kind of sprawl too. And this is lower income folks, especially whites, who are not so trapped in the city. They're moving out to where further out to the exurbs and so on, where homeownership where the land is more affordable and so on. At the same time, blacks are moving out if they have the means, but they're being trapped inside the city. And so you have this hollowing out of wealth from the downtown. It puts civil rights activists on the same page in terms of being concerned about sprawl as environmental activist. And so it creates this moment where there is more reaching out. There is alliance building. But at the same time, the environmental movement is still kind of invested in the program developed earlier, which is about nature and nature preservation. And when they look at sprawl and critique sprawl, they're talking about one thing. Whereas when the civil rights activists look at sprawl and worry about its consequences, they're looking at another thing. So there's a lot of sort of bridge building that happens. And I don't think my sense from looking at Atlanta is that by the 1980s, these movements were aligned and they saw the necessity of political alliance if they both were to achieve, like to get their congresspeople in office, and beginning to find common ground, but not quite there, that those political projects remained distinct. And it's only in the 1990s, I think, that you begin. You know, there are other pieces of this as well, in terms of maybe I should stop there. I'm wandering a little bit.
No, I'd love to hear more about that because I think I've done a bad job of helping you make clear to readers the way that you see a lot of. I don't know, similarities is too soft a word, but you watch dual processes of democratization being, the civil rights and the environmental movements are both benefiting from and producing democratization throughout this time, but very much on parallel but separate tracks. And then it's really, I was surprised to see, and I was convinced that it's really in the late 80s, where we might think things are quite dismal, is where we see the most convergence, or at least maybe now you're saying into the 90s, we start to see actual convergence where they're actually working together. For instance, to make this real, we have a Southern Environmental Assembly in 1988 in the city where the SCLC is a sponsor of that. John Lewis gives the opening remarks. And I wonder if you want to say more about the way that Lewis and other Black Atlantan politicians kind of represent this kind of moment of convergence and how why it wasn't any closer, why it didn't last longer, if you want to.
Well, I think you have to. Yeah, so I think there is this moment of convergence. I mean, the other piece of this, though, is that just to prepare the ground for this, one other point is that in places like North Atlanta, with the emergence of an environmental state, now you have the government actually actively creating nature parks and so on. A lot of the needs that people saw in the late 60s, early 70s for this environmental citizenship project are less concerning, especially as the upper middle class whites find their own neighborhoods and sort of separate themselves. And there is a growing class segregation within suburbs. They separate themselves from the rest of Atlanta, so they're less concerned, and it opens the door to a new conservative anti-environmental politics. And so a lot of that sort of the kind of sentiments that motivated environmentalists in Atlanta in the 60s and 70s are less of a concern to many of these people in these really wealthy developments in North Atlanta, where they fold in all the nature, and that becomes a big sales pitch. But they have less reason to push for the state to be involved, and are more susceptible to the anti-statism of this new conservative movement. That the Republican Party it starts with the Democratic Party, but the Republicans really take it over. In this very time period, they're doing this. So I think that the swallowing up of suburban environmental commitments by environmental consumption as well as the new conservatism, I think that also tilts the makeup of the environmental movement in Atlanta in a kind of urban direction. So more of the real activists are within the city itself. And that's another factor that I think is leading to this kind of convergence that is represented by that 1988 Southern Assembly.
Yeah, you do a nice job using Newt Gingrich as a way in to some of this reversal, and to say not only just why the Republican Party reversed itself on environmental policy, but much more broad than that, that actually this reversal helped to revive the moribund Republican Party in the state in that way, more broadly. How did that work?
So I think that's really critical to understanding why environmentalists have all these hopes in the late 80s that are then dashed. What Newt Gingrich does is he starts out as an environmentalist, and that's his calling card as an early aspiring, you know, congressional candidate in 72 and 74. I'm a charter member of the Georgia Conservancy. I created an environmental studies department in my college and really care about this stuff. But he loses a couple of times. And he realizes watching other congressional candidates like Larry McDonald, a Democrat who becomes and John Bircher, who develops this whole he's opposed actually to national parks. As against the Constitution, and really makes political hay with rural voters, I think, because of his opposition to the Chattahoochee Park. So Newt Gingrich is watching this. He's also he begins to cozy up to the big and big industrialists, especially, who are being slammed with these OSHA fines and environmental penalties wire company in his biggest in Carrollton, begins to tone down his environmentalism. So by 1978, when he does win congressional election, he has now really soft pedaled his endorsements and former endorsements by the Georgia Conservancy and Sierra Club, his opposition to pollution. It kind of way down his list of campaign priorities. Instead, what he's attacking is the welfare state. So the government is not there for him. He's not there really to protect environments. It's there to provide for other people, welfare, the poor people, the less deserving members of the society. And he moves on from there to forge a kind of a radically anti-statist message. It's radical for this time, but it soon becomes pretty normal for the Republican Party, where the whole goal is cutting government. And cutting government opens the door for markets and for private actors, and that's really where progress and technological change come from. And this is this whole conservative opportunity society. He also bonds with the new religious conservative movement, which becomes a pillar of Georgia conservatism as it asserts itself against a sort of imagined decline of American culture and morals and so on issues like the ERA, the women's rights, and abortion, of course, is a big issue, and gay rights is also in there, and so he bonds with those people as well, and it's a struggle over the 1980s. He becomes a national leader in Washington D.C., leading the Republican charge to get the Reagan administration's agenda through the Congress, but the Republicans remain a minority force really until the early 90s. After 1990 that the tide is turned and this great white shift occurs. Now, white voters in Georgia are already voting for people like Ronald Reagan. Preferring Republican presidential candidates, but they still prefer Georgia Democrats for statewide office. And this is up until the 1990s. And it's really with the various changes that come in after 1988, 1990, Gingrich suddenly is in charge of a party that by 1996, the Republicans make up the entirety of the white delegation from Georgia to the Congress, which is a really rapid reversal. I believe Gingrich, in 1989, he was still the only Republican representative, congressional representative. But there's this big shift that goes on. And I think, you know, the Republicans had made inroads with various statewide races in the 1980s. It was kind of back and forth. And 1989 was a low point, but they come charging back, roaring back. And by the early 2000s, they're in charge of the state government. They're winning all the statewide elections. So that's a really a frame shift in terms of political power in Georgia. And by extension, in the nation as well. I mean, Gingrich becomes the leader of this Congress that, I mean, among the other things, they want to cut the EPA budget by a third, and they want to really disempower it in so many ways. That's their proposal. Now, Democratic President Clinton turns that back. But I think all of these are sort of, I think we're still reckoning with the degree of transformation in our political arena that happened in those years in the 1990s, and with the South at the center of it, this great white shift in voter allegiance. And it happens in Atlanta too. I mean, for Atlanta, it becomes a suburban Republicanization. It's interesting too that I mean, the Republican support in Georgia really is hatched first in the suburbs. That's where Gingrich's early support lies, even as he turns that he's able to win even in his first two races. But it's getting the rural voters on board that is a Republican challenge, because they're so ingrained in sort of yellow dog Democratic allegiance. And that's what happens. That's what happens in the 1990s. They switch parties. And that's the Great White Shift. That's the Republicanization of Georgia. And of course, Atlanta becomes this place where blacks and whites there in the Democratic Party have to work together, and I think that's also, it becomes an occasion for the emergence of a black environmentalism as well. And John Lewis is a pretty good example of that. Somebody who really talks the talk of environmentalism as well as makes the political allegiances and political votes, does the right political voting, and the Black Caucus itself, it's legal conservation voter ratings are really go up, and it's the Black Congress people in Georgia, apportioned through the apportionment of Black majority districts, it's the Black Congress people that are the ones that have LCB ratings in the 90s. And then all the Republicans start to tail off, and Gingrich's rating, and I think it's 1994, is zero.
I'm sure he was proud of it.
Yes.
In the book's conclusion, you look at Atlanta today, and you argue that sustainability efforts that you see happening today tend to, or have a hard time not, exacerbating disparities in racial and class disparities. Can you tell us more about this, and what would it take to avoid that?
Well, I think that's where the strictly environmental fix, like let's make a park, let's build a Beltline, let's parkify the Beltline, you know, that those solutions are going to contribute to inequality rather than alleviate it. And I mean, my take on that is that they have to be accompanied by a careful attention to the policies that enable this environment, this economic inequity. And so things like housing, you need to, you know, you can't just build a belt line and expect that the city is going to somehow become more equitable by extending it, the belt line into the poorer and blacker parts of town. You also have to have policies that ensure that the housing that is built along the Beltline is going to have places for people who have less money. If you leave it up to the private sector, private entrepreneurs, actors, they're going to follow money. And that's, I think that's the long, you know, that's the, if there's one lesson from this long history of Atlanta is that, and environment and environmental politics, it's that environmental policy alone is not going to fix something like inequality, economic inequality. And in fact, if a consumerist solution, a reliance only on environmental consumption for our society is actually going to make that worse. Unless we also directly address some of the roots of economic inequality and things like homeownership and things like wages and salaries and things like your right to work, or allowing workers, enabling workers to organize and pursue their collectively pursue their self-interest is, I mean, those are so critical, I think, to reversing that pattern. And we're not going to buy our way. We're not going to spend our way out of all these environmental crises we're facing, you know, above all the climate crisis, without also addressing, without environmentalists should not just be looking at policies to do those, to fix those problems as discrete problems isolated out from something like economic inequality, but one also need to be proponents of fixing the problems that environmental, that that private or just isolated environmental solutions are going to worsen. And they're going to make a society less healthy and less democratic. I mean, otherwise we're headed for you know, something, some rekindling of what George's long experience should push us away from. It's a negative past that is, I think, hovering out there right now in some of the political dynamics going on in places like the Fulton County Courthouse.
All eyes on Georgia for the next few months or years, for sure. I have to let you go, but before, if I could be allowed a greedy question, greedy because this book is already such a gift and I could start again and read it right now and get a lot more out of it. But do you have any future projects you want to tell listeners about before you go?
Oh, yeah. We're already on an hour. Gosh. Yeah. No, I'm working on a lot of exciting and, I think, fun stuff. I mean, I have a book that I'm developing on climate. And climate and petropolises, oil cities, in Texas and Mexico, but also looking at the development of the oil industry, how it's shaped the cities there, also the questions in politics of pollution, and then of climate change that emerged in these cities, and that made them sort of national and international forces for exacerbating. I think our climate, our greenhouse emissions and our impact of climate on our future. I mean, so that's a pretty exciting book, and it's a sort of a different scope too, and a little bit sort of taking on the whole question of climate change, and then taking on the whole question of the American and international petroleum industry. And so, that's my next thing that I'm going to write up. I'm also working on I have another project on the EPA, doing as it is a team with my colleagues at the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative. We're looking into the historical impacts and lack of impact of the environmental justice movement on the EPA, and especially looking at its uses of data and science. And we're looking at EPA resistance as well as incorporation of what environmental justice activists have been fighting for the last 30 years. But the EPA has been, you know, a source of some, and more recently a source of hope, but also has a long record of reluctance and hesitancy and resistance, I think, that we're unpacking.
Okay. That's really exciting stuff on the horizon. But looking at the book that's right in front of us, this wonderful book, it again is called Race and the Greening of Atlanta, Inequality, Democracy, and Environmental Politics in an Ascendant Metropolis. It has just been published by the University of Georgia Press, and its author is, and my guest has been, Christopher Sellers. Chris, thank you so much for your time and for this book.
Okay. Thanks for this opportunity, Brian. I really appreciate it.